Hello, welcome to the Paediatric Physical Therapy Podcast. I'm Peter Goodwin, and later in the programme, we'll be hearing how you can use home videos to assess gross motor function.
A lot of parents bring video material to the practice to show to the paediatric physical therapist of the motor development of their infant. And we thought, well, could we use this for our work to make it easier for parents and infants and also for us as professionals to monitor gross motor development of infants?
Also at how virtual reality can improve gait in patients with cerebral palsy.
The training that they've done was on the treadmill, which was embedded in a virtual reality. So as they were walking, they were getting augmented feedback from the virtual reality. The virtual reality was projected on screens, so they had the impression that they were taking a nature walk. And if they were walking symmetrical, then the projected VR would create this impact of walking in a straight path.
And measuring hand grip strength.
You've got a child. You want to know if they have or he or she has an impairment in strength, which is often sort of measured very specifically because of simplicity using grip strength. So you can make an offhand judgment about whether this child's or an adolescent's strength was normal or not.
To start with, then, parents could be a big help in detecting motor function deficits early in life. That's according to a study that compared home videos to help to do this with standard tests done by a physical therapist in person. Marike Boonzaier from Utrecht in the Netherlands has been telling me there were advantages from using the family films.
In this digital society, we notice in practice that a lot of parents, young parents, bring video material to the practice to show to the pediatric physical therapist of the motor development of their infant. And we thought, well, could we use this for our work to make it easier for parents and infants and also for us as professionals to monitor gross motor development of infants with these home video recordings?
Okay, so the potential advantages, you've conducted a very meticulous study here because you have 48 infants. What did you do in the study?
Well, we wanted to compare the scores of the AIMS using a home video made by parents to an observation on site by a pediatric physical therapist. And we did both measurements simultaneously. So the parents made a home video of their infant while the pediatric physical therapist was on site doing the observation. And in a later stadium, another pediatric physical therapist who was blinded to the original assessment assessed the AIMS from the home video material made by parents. And we compared those two scores on the AIMS of that same infant.
What did you find?
Well, we found small differences. The mean difference was 0.48. item between live and video observations, and we concluded from our studies that both methods are comparable and both they can both be used in a valid way. What we noticed is that there was no systematic difference in the way that live observation were always scored higher than the video observation or the other way around. So in some cases, the live observation had a bit higher score on the infant. But in some cases, the person who checked the video material could see better and different items than the one who was at the live observation.
Right. What is this telling us then about measuring gross motor development of infants and how this could optimally be done in the future?
Well, we think that there are advantages using video material, and we also see in other measurements of infant motor development or child motor development that video observations are used more and more because they're easier to objectify, and afterwards you can also speak to a colleague about the video material you've seen on the child, which is not the case if you have live observation. You have to see it at once and score it at once, and then it's gone again.
Marike Boonzaier from the University of Applied Sciences in Utrecht, Netherlands. And with me on the line from Los Angeles is our editor, Linda Fetter. So, Linda, I suppose if you're a parent, you now have even more reason to pull your phone out and capture each moment when your baby moves.
Yes, there are two important points that were made in our clinical bottom line commentary for this research study. Each of our research studies has a clinical bottom line that's written by a researcher and a clinician pair. And in this particular clinical bottom line, a parent also was an author. The parent indicated that she would prefer to have a live session with a therapist face-to-face if she were given the choice, which I think is the important issue. So some parents would prefer live. It isn't always a choice. There are many parents who couldn't bring their child in, or it would be very difficult, or they're in rural settings where it's a long distance to get physical therapy care. So I think that's an important issue to attend to. The other point in the clinical bottom line is that our funding sources in many of the states in the United States have not caught up with this type of assessment. So if a physical therapist scored a videotape and had a conversation with the parent via telephone or some other media, they couldn't actually charge for that as a physical therapy session. And we need to work on that, because this study shows that this is a very valid way of getting assessment information on children. I know there's a project in Australia, Sydney, Australia, at the Cerebral Palsy Alliance Research Institute right now, and they are asking for therapists to send videotapes of infants, and they score them at a central database so that they've really improved the reliability and the validity of the scoring. So I think we have to embrace these alternatives for families, and we really need to get our third-party payers to understand that these are valid treatment and assessment options.
Right. Sounds like they're great ideas, Linda. Thanks for that. Let's look now at a big review of data from the National Institutes of Health Toolbox Project. It looks at grip strength in normal children and adolescents. Richard Bohannon from Campbell, North Carolina, explained to me what their motivation was for doing this.
Well, two things. The first being primarily that, as you indicate, it's a big data set. And a lot of the studies that are out there where people purport to describe normal performance, whether it be grip strength or something else, the samples really aren't very large, and very often they are what you would consider convenient samples. The same study involved a large number of older adults as well. But my recollection is they oversampled young people.
Right.
The big numbers.
So run me through what, in fact, you were able to measure, or what were the measurements that came out of this?
Basically, what we wanted to know was, for dividing it up so it would be useful for clinicians, at least in the United States, is we wanted to know, obviously, what people's grip strength was on both hands, and then also what their age was. But we also determined, or got from the database, information on things like weight and height, because some people suggested that sort of normal values should be further standardized or normalized against things such as height or weight. So those were the main things, but the key element, of course, was grip strength.
Now, of course, if you're caring for a child with cerebral palsy, some of these features are really important, grip strength. So how do you relate what you've been measuring to the situation where you're looking after a patient with a disability?
What it allows you to do, basically, is if you have appropriate standards for comparison. So, for example, this might be the case. If you had a child that was 3 years old, that was a girl, and had cerebral palsy, well, we present data in our study for three-year-old girls. So what would allow you to do is make some judgments about the degree of impairment demonstrated by that individual, in keeping with, in this case, her sex and her age.
Now, briefly, what were the data coming out of your study then?
Basically, we provided two sorts of normative data. One, actually, we did three things. We created a table where we summarized what we could find where other people have attempted to do this. So it puts our own findings into perspective. But then what we do is we also have a table in which we divide things up by age and gender or sex. And we're able to do that because what we found is that these other factors like height and weight, though important, did not add all that much to what I might call the accuracy of predicting what strength should be. So we have a table so someone could go to the table and say, oh, as they say, I have a three-year-old girl. I'm going to go to the table and look at the dominant side grip strength and the non-dominant side grip strength. And I could look at both the average. I could look at the median, you know, which cuts everything in half, or I could look at different percentiles, and it would allow you to have a fairly specific idea about where that person stood in regard to strength. And then the other thing is we developed regression equations. So rather than comparing values to a table, you would go into those equations and, for example, if it's linear regression, one of the equations involved would be, say, for boys on the non-dominant side, and it would involve age and weight. So you would have sort of beta or weighted factors that you throw in there, but then also take age and weight into account to predict what that boy's grip strength should be.
Right, so now you have got predicted grip strengths. Are you able to say at this point then that you've defined what those grip strengths should be?
I would say yes. Just to go back to something else you asked before, though, very briefly, a child did not have to necessarily be normal to be included in the data set. And so what we did is we eliminated people that were, I don't remember the specifics, but let's say 3 standard deviations from the mean of other, say, boys in that age group or other girls in that age group. So once you do all that, then you are able to say, well, those were outliers. Therefore, we can be highly confident that this is the strength that one should be. Though that's a relatively broad range for people of, say, boys or girls of a certain age. Yes, I would say it's pretty definitive, at least for people in the United States.
So tell me then how you think this is going to be used or how it should be used.
Well, I hope that what people will start doing once it's out there, they're going to be using these things to determine whether an individual has an impairment or not. And that can be whether they're, you know, less than average, whether they're at a certain percentile that's less than the median. That could be there are a certain number of standard deviations below the mean. There are a number of ways you can play that game. But basically, it's going to allow them to make those pointed decisions regarding whether there's a problem with this person. And as you said, it could be someone with CP. It could be a child with muscular dystrophy. It could be a child without a definitive diagnosis yet. But in doing the test, you would realize that, wow, this person really isn't where I would expect him or her to be based on age, say, and maybe weight.
Right. That was Richard Bohannon, professor of physical therapy at Campbell University, North Carolina. It seems there's quite a lot of good data coming up in this edition of Pediatric Physical Therapy, Linda. And I wonder, his data was normative data. I wonder, Linda, could you explain to me just how important it is to have such data from the overall population when you're assessing disability, and how should clinicians be making use of it?
It's critical for us to have an idea of how movement aspects develop typically. And I think what Dr. Bohannon and colleagues have accrued for us and published is a very large data set on what should we expect in terms of grip strength for typically developing 3 to 17-year-olds. It becomes particularly important to have a large data set the younger the subjects, because the variability in any given motor ability is greater in younger children than it tends to be in older children and in adults. So you need a very large data set to capture the typical variation, so you're not seeing the wide variability, you're not seeing that as atypical, but this is what we expect, and it's quite variable in young children, let's say as young as 3 years of age. So often we see small data sets that are trying to establish normative values, and they just don't work because they typically don't capture the normal variability, particularly in young children.
And how are clinicians going to be using these normative data then?
They'll use it probably most likely for assessment purposes. Where is the child I'm seeing in comparison to where typically developing children are? It doesn't mean that you necessarily expect that the child with movement problems to end up developing typically, but at least you have a sense of what might I expect of a 3-year-old or a 5-year-old or a 17-year-old, and then where does the person I'm seeing fall within that spectrum.
Right, and some pretty accurate data. Now, more yes. precise physiological data is coming up in the next story. This time it's about key measurements to assess children with cerebral palsy with different gross motor function classification levels. Jose Manuel Sanz Mengibar, who works in both Madrid and London, and actually he's now started working in Germany too, he's been telling me how he's been using 3D kinematics to see how trunk positions change with the level of motor function.
This study of pediatric physical therapy is a part of a bigger project that tries to show the relationships between the posture and the movement of the lumbar spine and the gross motor function. It would be important to know how this relation evolves during typical development and then understand how this development freezes and looks for an alternative pattern which can produce deformities and future limitation for this patient.
What did you actually do then in the study?
We wanted to measure the lumbar spine, and we did it indirectly through the relationship between the movement of the trunk and the pelvic segments. We wanted to do it dynamically instead of with passive movement. We wanted to do it through a pattern, and we decided a gait was the best pattern to do it because it's the particular human pattern, because we have a very good devices to measure it exactly. So what we did is we measure the lumbar spine relationship between the trunk and the pelvic segments through the gait of children with cerebral palsy, those who could walk, obviously.
Now, you had quite a big group. You've got 97 children, so this is a big study.
It is a big study, yeah. We also recorded healthy children, almost 100, but this is not included on this study, in order to compare also with the children with cerebral palsy, yeah.
So what did you find?
Basically, the most important conclusions we found, it was the basal and maintenance values of the lumbar curve on the sagittal plane depend on the functional level of the children with cerebral palsy who are able to walk. This means that there is a specific postural control in the average and minimal values of the lumbar spine in the sagittal plane during gait for the transition among the gross motor function classification system levels between 1 and 3.
You've got some very specific technical scientific findings. What are the clinical implications of this knowledge?
So basically, understanding the relationship between the years of atypical walking and the opposite progression of the lumbar spine on the sagittal plane should reinforce the importance of the quality of movement in the therapeutic inputs in contrast to intense functional training. For example, maybe an intervention in the future research, which you should study the effect of the spine position, could be studied in combination with function. That means that maybe an intervention could not change directly the function, but it modifies the spine towards the next level of function or towards the normative values, which may reduce deformities in these children with cerebral palsy.
Supposing you have a young person with cerebral palsy, what are the actions that you would take to optimize their growth and development based on the new knowledge that you've got from your study?
This research doesn't study specific therapeutic intervention. What is important to understand if it's in the future, if we use any therapeutic inputs, we will need to not only assess, for example, in the gait analysis, the lower limb, as we usually do, but we may also need to implement trunk models in order to understand what is the impact of a therapeutic intervention on the lumbar spine. Because the lumbar spine, we know now, is fully related with function, which is the ultimate goal in all our research or our clinical goals.
What are the clinical bottom line or potential clinical bottom line messages coming out of this then?
Well, the bottom line could be that it seems possible that improving the basal and maintenance capacities of the trunk control, we could produce clinically significant improvements in gross motor function and mobility in children with cerebral palsy. The second conclusion will be that in children with cerebral palsy, higher classifications of gross motor skills correlate with more extended lumbar spine. For those children who cannot walk independently, the effect of the development or the effect of the age is reversed instead, flexing the lumbar spine.
What should other physical therapists be taking home from this right now, do you think?
Well, the main thing is this article outstands the important role of the spine during three-dimensional gait analysis and also as an outcome of our therapeutical interventions. And not only the lower limb kinematics and kinetics as we were looking for. So every single intervention, we may consider that in order to reach a better level of functionality, we now know we depend on the position of the spine. At the moment, we know lumbar spine, but we need to look at in the future also the thoracical spine and also not only the sagittal plane, but also other planes of the spine.
Right. That was Jose Manuel Sanz Menkivar from Balance Physio in London and the UK, who also works elsewhere. And it sounds pretty clever stuff to me, Linda. He was talking about precise measurements of lumbar curve and the relationship between spine position and function in cerebral palsy. Can you explain to me the importance of all this in your opinion?
Yes, I think we need to be cautious. And I think in this study they were cautious about looking at functional movements such as captured in the gross motor function classification system and what underlies the achievement of specific functions. In this particular study, the authors have associated lumbar trunk position with specific classification levels on the GM-FCS. And I think that's interesting. But I do think that, and as the authors have suggested, we can't assume that intervening with the lumbar trunk, working towards improving the lumbar trunk alignment, et cetera, perhaps flexibility, will necessarily impact function. That's something that needs to be demonstrated in an intervention study. So it's often that first you have an association and then you think, well, perhaps what we should do is design a study that really tests this. Is this, if we work at this level of lumbar spine, are we actually going to improve gross motor function? And I think that work is yet to be done.
It's pretty exciting to hear that such detailed scientific explorations are being done, though, isn't it?
Yes.
Maybe we can stay with gait now, because there's another paper in the latest Pediatric Physical Therapy journal. It looks at gait training in cerebral palsy and the use of virtual reality to provide visual feedback to reduce gait asymmetry. Ilana Levine has been using VR to help adults with CP learn how to improve their gait.
The main motivation is that we're actually seeing that adults with CP do not maintain their function and do not maintain their walking abilities. So once the evidence are piling about that, our question was, okay, can we do something to help them improve their gait or ameliorate the deterioration? So the main question was, can they learn? Can we teach them something new? Can we modify their gait, make it more efficient?
Right. So you're looking at gait asymmetry. What did you try to do with these patients?
So we chose gait asymmetry as one of the deficit that is a common deviation of the gait. And we try to see whether we can teach them a more symmetrical gait and whether the reduction in the asymmetry, if we're able to achieve that, would that improve other qualities, other characteristics of walking.
Now, I'd like to ask you what you did in the study. And it was quite an exciting study for the patients because they were able to go into a virtual reality environment. How did you conduct the study? What did you do?
The training that they've done was on the treadmill, which was embedded in a virtual reality. So as they were walking, they were getting augmented feedback from the virtual reality. The virtual reality was projected on screens, so they had the impression that they were taking a nature walk. And if they were walking symmetrical, then the projected VR would create this impact of walking in a straight path. If they were more asymmetrical, then the scenery would move to the side so that they had this feeling of them curving or walking in a curve. So their goal was kind of to play with that and try to go straight in that scenery.
Right, so you had five patients doing this. Mm-hmm. What happened?
Each of them trained for 18 sessions. They were giving this augmented feedback. They were also given some instructions from the PT how they might experience and try different things with their gait and how they can modify their gait. And then with our outcomes, with our primary outcome, which is the change in the symmetry, what we found is that all of them were able to demonstrate a more symmetrical gait on their post-tests and eventually or their on their 6 weeks follow-up. On our secondary outcomes, which were their speed of walking, their distance during 6 minutes walk, and we also tested their cost of walking with a metabolic cart, so how much oxygen they actually were using to do these 6 minutes. And we tested balance, and we tested daily walking. So on these secondary outcomes, some of them improved on various combinations of these outcomes. So not necessarily all had the same secondary outcomes. But in general, I think the exciting part is that we were able to demonstrate, first of all, that this intervention is feasible. The outcomes are possible to collect data using these outcomes. And then most exciting was that they actually were capable of improving their gait, and the training had short-term and a little longer term positive outcomes.
Ilana Levine from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, with what seems to me to be a fun way of improving your function. Do you think, Linda, that these sorts of virtual reality or electronic gaming methods can provide effective solutions for performance deficiencies such as with gait?
Yes, I think we're seeing in this study that Dr. Levine and co-authors have demonstrated that the virtual reality can actually be used very nicely. And what you described, Peter, as fun, why shouldn't therapy be fun, for adults who have gait problems? And there's another important aspect of this study, and that is that they studied adults, 18 to 65-year-olds. And although we're a journal of pediatric physical therapy, cerebral palsy first presents in childhood. And it's important for us to sort of ask the question, what happens as individuals with cerebral palsy age? What happens in terms of their overall function? And here's a study that's really followed the ability for adults to walk and to benefit from this kind of visual feedback in a laboratory.
Sounds good to me. Now, managing cystic fibrosis in children now, and a systematic review has appeared in the journal that looks at self-help breathing, a self-help breathing method called autogenic drainage. It compared this in children with traditional physical therapy methods, such as there's a technique called postural drainage. And on the line from Cape Town, South Africa, Lieselotte Corton told me first why the study was needed.
So postural drainage is more of a passive technique, while autogenic drainage is an independent technique. So kids can do it by themselves if they're old enough to do it. So if it's independent, of course, kids will prefer it more, and then hopefully we get a better adherence to treatment. So that's one of the reasons that autogenic drainage is out there. The clinicians actually want to know if it is effective or not.
Right. Now, you've looked at some studies that are already out there. What data did you manage to get out of these studies?
Well, we found 7 randomized control trials. However, only 2 of them gave us explicit pediatric data. And it's actually only one of them who only focused on children and did not include adults. So we weren't able to identify a lot of research in the pediatric population.
Do you then have a conclusion coming out of this study so far?
Well, we weren't actually able to make a clear conclusion, but of course, that means we need to do more research and find out if it actually works or not. In clinical practice, we can't say it works or it doesn't work at the moment, but we also didn't find anything that reflected any adverse events or any downsides. So it's a little bit like, what should we do? We did find small effects. One study did found that there was small effect of autogenic drainage being more effective than postural drainage. But of course, we can't base ourselves on one study.
That was Lieselotte Corton from Cape Town, South Africa. She's a lecturer in pediatric physical therapy at the Hutashur Hospital. And still on the line from Los Angeles, we have our editor, Linda Fetters, from the University of Southern California. Linda, that was what I would call a negative finding, but in science and clinical practice, negative findings are pretty important. What would you pass on to clinicians from this, clinicians who are managing children with CF?
I think what's important from this study is the phrase, we don't know. And when, excuse me, authors do a systematic review, it's a comprehensive survey of what is in the research literature. What can we say? And sometimes we have enough research to make a statement and to make a clinical recommendation. In this case, the answer really is we don't know. We don't have enough research. The reason that's important is that if you're a researcher, and if you're a clinical researcher interested in various pulmonary cleansing techniques, here's a research project falling into your lap that we need more data before we can make conclusive statements. It appears that there isn't harm in the techniques that were studied, and as a consequence, proceeding carefully with these techniques seems judicious, but we clearly need more research before we can make a definitive clinical statement.
Right. Well, that looks like a good plan to have some more research on that and get some more of these very valuable data. And meanwhile, rehabilitation for cerebral palsy has been under the scrutiny of Mary Genotti from West Hartford, Connecticut. She's summarized data from 14 sources, national, state, and local, all within the United States. She was looking at health, function, and well-being in children with CP, and she's also looked at the health services they used. Her bottom line?
The bottom line is that children with cerebral palsy are not utilizing services to the extent that other children are, that they have poorer health, they have more barriers to care, and that they have unmet needs for therapy and for equipment. So these sources of data can help us justify the need for more programs and more intense interventions and the provision of appropriate equipment.
Now, faced with this need, this unmet need, as you've described it, what should physical therapists individually be doing, do you think, right now?
Well, on the individual level, the clinician, you know, just should continue to advocate for services. And I know that there's a great deal of barriers with third-party payers, and there's also barriers because families are stressed out. My main point for clinicians is that in order for us to get the information that we want as therapists, what particular intervention works the best for which type of child and at what age, we have to be committed to documenting. And documenting in a systematic way and joining across centers and across institutions, the common data elements that were created by the National Institutes of Health for research to document in such a way that we can answer those questions. That's probably the clinical bottom line for this article, that therapists, to get the information they need, that they need and they want, we have to be committed to documenting in a systematic way.
Mary Genotti from the Department of Rehabilitation Services at the University of Hartford in West Hartford, Connecticut. Linda, quick word from you. What do you make of it?
It's a wonderful demonstration of a project, a very large, very comprehensive project in which Dr. Genotti and her colleagues have looked at a number of databases and summarized across the databases so that we have facts, we have data to inform our statements, our opinions, and our advocacy for the patients that we see. And I think that's obviously increasingly important for us to have accurate data and for us to have summary data from as many sources as possible to bring together and then to scrutinize that data. What is it that data can tell us? And I think they've done a really outstanding job of bringing together an extraordinary amount of information into clinical practice.
Right. Thanks for that, Linda. Well, it seems hard facts, real data, very much part of this edition of Pediatric Physical Therapy. And your comment there, Linda, brings this edition of the Pediatric Physical Therapy podcast to an end. I hope everybody's enjoyed listening and that you'll join our editor, Linda Fetters, and me, Peter Goodwin, again in 3 months' time. Goodbye.